Welcome to Politics and Reality Radio. I'm Joshua Holland. This week, we'll be joined by David K. Johnston to help sort out all of the guilty pleads and convictions and phony tough guys who flipped in the Trump-Russia case this week, or I guess it's now expansive Trump money laundering, tax evasion, conspiracy to violate campaign finance laws, Gate or Ghazi. Then we're going to be joined by Stefan Lewandowski. He's a professor of psychology at the University of Bristol, who wrote this week about how there's a connection between creationism and a tendency to buy into conspiracy theories. And finally, we'll be speaking with Cliff Albright. He's a co-founder of Black Voters Matter Fund, the Black Voters Matter Fund. And this is yet another group that is out there doing the hard work in the trenches to push back against Trumpism. And regular listeners know I'd like to highlight these organizations because they offer a glimmer of hope in these otherwise dark times. But first, you know, I think one of the most extraordinary revelations this week was that the National Enquirer has been maintaining an expansive compromise operation. According to the Associated Press, the tabloid made a habit of buying damaging stories about celebrities and burying them in a safe, and that safe then became, quote, a great source of power for David Pecker, the CEO of the Enquirer's parent company, AMI. So, you know, there were the stories about Trump's sordid affairs, of course. And they were, and I quote the AP again, stored alongside similar documents pertaining to other celebrities' catch and kill deals, in which exclusive rights to people's stories were brought with no intention of publishing to keep them out of the news. By keeping celebrities' embarrassing secrets, the company was able to ingratiate itself with them and ask for favors in return. It's like J. Edgar Hoover, you know? We have gotten to stupid Watergate at this point. So this story came out when the Wall Street Journal reported that Pecker and the unfortunately named head of AMI, David Pecker, God, it's been a terrible week for bad puns on Twitter, had been granted immunity by federal prosecutors working on the Michael Cohen case. That probe was initiated when Robert Mueller referred it to the Southern District of New York, right? And this all highlights for me how little we know about what Mueller and his two dozen or so hotshot investigators and prosecutors have on the Trump crime family. And I've been thinking this week about Felix Sater. Sater, you'll recall, is the ex-con with links to the Russian mob who worked on and off with Trump, quote, in search of deals in Russia and other former Soviet republics, according to Bob Dreyfus of The Nation, for nearly a decade, right? Dreyfus wrote of Sater that, and I'll quote, of all the characters caught up in Russiagate, none come close to Sater for having a decades-long record as a larger-than-life, outside-the-law, spy agency-linked Wheeler dealer. His past record includes a conviction for lacerating a man's face with a broken margarita glass in a bar brawl and his involvement in a multi-million dollar stock fraud and money laundering scheme. So how does this tie in? Well, it ties in the money laundering side. It's been 13 months since the Financial Times reported that Sater, who had funneled lots of cash from oligarchs in the Eastern Bloc into Trump properties, was cooperating with federal prosecutors. Those federal prosecutors are looking into international money laundering in connection with the Trump-Russia probe. And I bring this up because we haven't heard much about that angle since. 13 months ago, Financial Times says, oh, Sater is working with these prosecutors. And we've heard almost nothing about Trump and Russian money laundering, you know, which is a story that was out there in connection with his Atlantic City casinos years ago. So this is not new. And I just want to bring this up because as everyone debates whether, you know, this felony or that outrage will finally prove to be the beginning of the end of Trump's presidency, I think it's important to keep in mind that if and when that moment comes, it's very likely to be something that we didn't see coming in advance, because Mueller's team has been so quiet and free of leaks, right? And it seems like, you know, the old iceberg metaphor, or, you know, we only see 1% of it that's floating above the surface, and most of it is as yet invisible to us. Anyway, with that, let's take a quick break and then come back and continue to discuss this kind of sprawling investigation with David K. Johnston.
Homegrown alligator, see you later. Gotta hit the road, gotta hit the road. The sun ain't changing the atmosphere. Architecture unfamiliar, I could get used to this. Time flies by in the yellow and green. Stick around and you'll see what I mean. There's a mountain top that I'm dreaming of. If you need me, you know where I'll be. I'll be riding shotgun underneath the hot sun, feeling like a someone. I'll be riding shotgun underneath the hot sun, feeling like a someone. We're south of the equator, navigator. Gotta hit the road, gotta hit the road. Deep sea diving round the clock, bikini bottoms, lager tops. I could get used to this. Time flies by in the yellow and green. Stick around and you'll see what I mean. There's a mountain top that I'm dreaming of. If you need me, you know where I'll be. I'll be riding shotgun underneath the hot sun, feeling like a someone. I'll be riding shotgun underneath the hot sun, feeling like a someone. We got two in the front, two in the back, sailing along. Mountain top that I'm dreaming of. If you need me, you know where I'll be. I'll be riding shotgun underneath the hot sun, feeling like a someone. I'll be riding shotgun underneath the hot sun, feeling like a someone. I'll be riding shotgun underneath the hot sun, feeling like a someone.
Welcome back. I'm still Joshua Holland, and I'm always pleased to be joined by my next guest. David K. Johnston is a legendary reporter, Pulitzer Prize-winning former tax reporter for the New York Times. David, and also an intrepid chronicler of our 45th president. David K. Johnston, welcome back to the show.
Well, thank you, Joshua, for having me on.
Thank you for taking the time. So how significant is, among all of the revelations this week, how significant is the report that Alan Weisselberg, who is Trump's CFO and right-hand man for decades and decades, has been granted immunity to cooperate with prosecutors in the Michael Cohen case?
Oh, tremendously important. All of the money in the Trump organization and the personal money of the Trump family members flowed through Weisselberg and bookkeepers and functionaries who worked below him. Every sensitive matter was run by him. Now, Weisselberg may not have been party to every criminal action by Donald Trump and members of his family that took place. That is, he may have simply been told, write a check or do this. But nonetheless, he was deeply involved in many of these matters. And I think it's important to distinguish something. There are people who go to the prosecutors and say, I really want to tell you what I know, but I want immunity, and they agree to cooperate. There are other people who are called before a grand jury or called in for an interview ahead of a grand jury who say, I'm going to invoke my Fifth Amendment rights. And prosecutors then grant immunity, which eliminates your Fifth Amendment rights because you no longer can incriminate yourself if you can't be prosecuted. It appears in this case that Wesselberg did not, to use Donald Trump's language, rat out the boss,
right,
but rather was given immunity so that he would be forced to testify.
So they're playing hardball with him. They also have granted immunity to David Pecker, the CEO of American Media, Inc., a parent company to the National Enquirer. And this is all in connection with, again, the Cohen case. So does it feel like they're layering corroborating witnesses for that story, or is there more going on?
Oh, I think there's a lot more going on than what we've seen so far. But the legal vice on Donald Trump and his criminal empire is tightening. And here's what you're going to see. When you have an organization like Trump's, which is built entirely on loyalty to the boss, you keep those people who will do whatever the boss says because they like their job or they're compromised or whatever, and you push out people who are in any way independent or demonstrate any disagreement with the boss. Donald Trump, when I was covering him heavily in the late 80s and early 90s, fired one of the most competent casino executives in the world, who's gone on to a fabulous career, and replaced him with a literally falling down drunk because he was of the, yes, Mr. Trump, whatever you want, sir, absolutely, school.
Right.
Well, once you get the first person to break through into the criminal enterprise, which is what I believe the Trump Organization fundamentally is, then other people began to recognize that they have to make a choice. In the case of a person like Alan Weisselberg, it's a good thing he's been granted immunity because were they instead to say, fine, keep your Fifth Amendment rights, we're going to prosecute you, we don't need your testimony, he's 71 years old. Based on federal tax charges, he could easily spend the rest of his life in prison. And this is very, very important, Josh. At DC Report, the singular, dcreport.org, the news service that I and friends of mine created after Donald Trump won the Electoral College, we have been crusading to get state criminal tax investigations of not of the Trump Foundation, Donald Trump, his children, the Trump Organization. The reason for that is that New York state tax law and rules are virtually parallel to federal. They differ basically only for retirees. And were Donald Trump to shut down the Mueller investigation, state investigations he has no power over, he has no power of pardon, no power of commuting sentences. So it's critically important that the state authorities develop their own criminal charges. And imagine the political impact if we all wake up one morning and go out to get our morning paper, if hopefully we still get one at the door, because I think democracy depends on that kind of level of information. And the screaming headline across the top is Trump indicted, or Donald Trump Jr. indicted, or Trump Organization indicted.
Right.
It changes the whole ballgame and gets people to begin to recognize what Donald Trump has successfully hidden from anybody, that he has spent his entire life as a major league white-collar criminal who swindles investors, who cheats business owners, who doesn't pay workers, and who has repeatedly, I'm absolutely positive, the events will show, cheated the state and federal governments on taxes.
Now, New York Attorney General Barbara Underwood did seek out a criminal referral from the New York State Department of Taxation and Finance this week.
After we began crusading for her to do that.
And there's another
issue.
Let me
be very clear. When we originally brought this up, Barbara Underwood's office basically, when I got her PR woman, just she started out right out of the box just literally screaming at me. I mean, not even a hi. What exactly do you want? You know, we think that's, not so, or it's crazy, or what, you know, what it was. The first words out of her mouth were screaming and screaming. I kept saying, would you calm down? You haven't even heard the questions yet. And she continued screaming at me. And that, by the way, is how subsequent conversations went. Now Underwood has done what we called on Governor Cuomo to do, which was to make a referral or for her to ask for one. And, of course, Zephyr Teachout, the progressive candidate for attorney general in New York on the Democratic slate, was the very first one of those four candidates to say, I will go after the Trump Organization, and if I become attorney general next January, the very first thing I'm going to do is ask for a criminal referral on Trump, the Trump Organization, and the Trump Foundation.
We had Teach Out on the show 3 weeks ago to talk about this very issue. There is another issue with New York in terms of their Cuomo has finally called for a law that allows people who are pardoned of a federal crime to be prosecuted for state charges that mirror that crime. This is a change that New York needs to make.
Yeah, it's a loophole in New York law that normally, if you are pardoned for a federal offense, but there's a parallel state offense, a state government can prosecute you for that. We saw this in civil rights cases, for example, where states would try people, they'd be acquitted, and then we'd try them on federal charges, and they
this
would
be convicted.
This
is the doctrine of dual sovereignty, right?
That's right. The doctrine of, and it is what the conservative Republicans who call themselves today federalists, they used to call themselves states' rights advocates, should be applauding, although their silence is pretty deafening on this. And this loophole was that except for tax crimes, if you were pardoned by the president, you couldn't be criminally prosecuted in New York. Well, there's no reason to have that. It's a technical loophole. A lot of loopholes are done deliberately or done because somebody strategized for them. This is just a legislative screw-up, and there's no reason not to fix it. And Andrew Cuomo, who has his eyes on the White House for beginning in 2021, has been reluctant all the way along to get tough with the Trumps and the Trump administration. I mean, he's really been, in my opinion, cowardly and has neglected his duty. If I, as a resident of New York State or anybody else, did the things that Donald Trump has done, and we should be, you know, investigated, indicted, prosecuted, and if convicted, sent to prison. And Andrew Cuomo has treated Donald Trump differently because he's prominent and wealthy. That's not how the law is supposed to work. We're not supposed to cower in front of wealth or money. We're not supposed to protect people who are in our social or economic circle. And we are supposed to be a nation of equality under law. So I'm glad that Governor Cuomo has seen the error of his ways and has begun moving in the right direction. But it is important to keep in mind that he had to be pushed to go there.
Yeah, he's touting his progressive accomplishments, but he's had to be pushed on every single one of them, and every single one of them has been watered down thanks to continued Republican control of the Senate, despite the fact that they haven't won control. They're controlling the Senate thanks to turncoat Democrats. So there's a lot going on in New York State this election cycle. I mentioned in the introduction, David, that, you know, we've been hearing little dribs and drabs about, you know, the payoffs to women who claim that they had affairs with Donald Trump. We hear about tax issues, et cetera, et cetera. And yet it's been 13 months since it was reported that Felix Sater is cooperating with federal probe into money laundering. What do you think the likelihood is that, and I know I'm asking for speculation, but what do you think the likelihood is that at the end of all of this road is just a massive money laundering scandal with Russia and perhaps other countries?
Well, there's going to be a massive money laundering scandal, but I don't think that's necessarily the end of the road. Here's what I see going on here. Robert Mueller got these 17 lawyers, all of whom I'm sure were making at least $1 million a year, and I wouldn't be shocked if some were making $8 or $10 million a year, to leave those very lucrative private positions for a prosecutor's salary of roughly $180,000. They are doing that because they all understand this is the most important thing they will ever do in their lives, and because they are, unlike Donald, patriotic Americans. They have been taking the cases they have and shifting many of them off to other people. It was something I was going to write about a DC report, and then Rachel Maddow beat me to it and did a better job probably than I would have done because she has a whole staff of people. But the Cohen case and a variety of other cases have been shifted to other prosecutors. Now, that strategy is important for two reasons. One is it makes sure that if Trump ever shuts down Mueller, lots of other cases will continue. But it also tells you that the workload on the 17 lawyers and the FBI agents who've been assigned to them to do the detective work is so big that they've got to stay focused on what they're doing. If there's anything we know about Robert Mueller, is that he is a determined, focused, professional prosecutor and law enforcement agent. He's not going to be diverted by anything. He doesn't care what we say about him in the media. He doesn't care about Donald Trump's tweets. He cares about doing the job and doing it absolutely meticulously. And all you have to do is read the legal filings of these lawyers to realize that they are telling a story and they're doing it in plain, clear English so that not only will judges get it, but the public will get what they're finding. And whenever it is that he moves to issue his report, we're going to find out what I've been saying all through this interview and for years, and that is the Trump Organization is basically a white-collar criminal organization. It makes money by cheating people, laundering money, not paying workers, not paying vendors, concocting phony tax deductions. And it will also, I'm sure, show very, very deep ongoing relationships to Russian gangsters. When I say Russian, I mean Russian-speaking people, so they might be Kazakhs or Georgians or Ukrainians, as well as Russians. Russian gangsters, Russian oligarchs, and the Kremlin itself. And I think it is very significant that the New York Times lead story this morning, Saturday the 25th of August, by Julian Barnes, who I know as a reporter and another reporter at the New York Times, who are deeply steeped in covering national security issues and are very prudent, reliable reporters, that all of America's intelligence assets in the Kremlin have gone silent. We're not getting any intelligence from people who were, whether they were doing it as double agents or directly, were helping us in the Kremlin. That is deeply disturbing to our national security, and it traces directly back, I believe, to the fact that current president of the United States is not a loyal American. I mean, I think the overwhelming evidence is that he's a traitor, and I mean that in the political, not the strictly legal sense.
Yes.
Because you can't commit treason except at time of war, and we haven't been in a declared war since 1945.
Right.
But his relationship with the Russians and his taking the as fact and truth, the statements in private to him by Vladimir Putin over the entire leadership of the American intelligence establishment tells you that the kindest possible thing you could say about Donald Trump is that the man has divided loyalties, and someone with divided loyalties is not fit to be president of the United States and is violating his oath of office.
I mean, I would say that he's loyal to himself and maybe his
daughter,
absolutely. Right? I mean, it's a
narcissist. In my current book, it's even worse than you think what the Trump administration is doing to America. I go through some of the 44 prior presidents who've ranged from, you know, smart to stupid, murderous to timid, good to bad. I mean, a whole host and mix of people. But every single one of them tried to make the country better in the terms of the times they lived in and what they were doing. The only president we've ever had who's tried to make the country worse is Donald Trump, and that's because the Donald Trump presidency is not about America. It's not about our society. It is about the vainglorious Donald Trump, who believes, and you know, I've covered Donald for more than 30 years. Trust me, he really believes that he is superior to the rest of us. When he calls other people idiots and stupid and fools, it's because he believes that he is the superior human being and that, of course, he should run America for the rest of his life. He should run the whole world for the rest of his life. I mean, here's a man who interviewed on Fox and Friends this week. Indicated his ignorance of the Constitution. He says there's something about high crimes in the Constitution, a document he has never read and has no idea what's in it, and who says he's doing such a great job. You know, why would you impeach someone doing such a great job? And if we did that, we'd all be poor. This is all about his mind, and in many ways, Donald is delusional. He'll tell you that people have said things to him that we know never happened. We literally have a mentally ill man in the White House, and he needs treatment. We don't need him as president.
Yeah, it is stunning. I still struggle to wrap my head around how we got here. Let me just add that according to that New York Times report that David was just talking about, one of the potential reasons that our intelligence assets have gone dark in Russia is the efforts by House Republicans to quote unquote unmask intelligence operatives in the service of their kooky conspiracy theories. And there's the reporters speculated that that may be playing a role in people shutting up because they know that they're not going to be protected by the U.S. government. It's an extremely serious situation.
Absolutely. And if a single one of our assets is executed by the Putin regime, I think that we should find a way to prosecute and imprison any member of Congress who did this. I mean, it's astonishing to see the Republicans who I grew up in the 50s and 60s.
Right.
To see the Republicans who were constantly warning us about the dangers of Russia and communism become the friends and allies of these people, making trips there, defending them. Rand Paul, the small L, as he calls himself, conservative libertarian from Kentucky, Devin Nunes, the head of the Intelligence Committee, acting as what the Soviets would have called useful idiots.
Yes.
And you know, Kevin Brady, the number two Republican in the House, said that the only two people on the Kremlin's payroll were Donald Trump and Dana Rohrabacher, a congressman from California, a very right-wing congressman from California. I think there was a lot of truth in that statement.
Yeah, I do too. David K. Johnston, I believe we are out of time. I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me and sort out these issues. I really do appreciate it.
Josh, thank you for having me on. Take care.
Folks, stay tuned. We're going to take a quick break and then come right back.
Fighting to keep one smile. Will the people speak in our mind? Yeah, once more, who do say it from me now?
Dynamite blast with the force of war. Government rides on the weekend boy. Don't want to see my brother FN no more. When the little man fights all the big man's war.
One sentence they victimize. Bent on slavery with a clever disguise. Uprise and our people must rise.
Beside your faith and life won't wait. Life won't wait, no. Life won't wait.
The vision is a new one.
Life won't wait.
The vision is a new
one.
The vision is a new one.
Come along and tell your sister and your brother.
Welcome back. I'm still Joshua Holland, and I'm joined now by Stefan Lewandowski. Professor Lewandowski is the chair of cognitive psychology at the University of Bristol, and he wrote an intriguing piece this week at The Conversation. It's titled, There's a Psychological Link Between Conspiracy Theories and Creationism. Professor, welcome to Politics and Reality Radio.
Oh, well, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
Thanks for taking the time. So it seems like a controversial topic. What is teleological thinking, and how is creationism linked to the belief in conspiracy theories?
Well, to answer the first question, teleological thinking means that you're trying to explain events, natural events, by presuming some sort of purpose or intentionality. So, for example, if you ask a child why they think it is raining, they might answer, oh, well, it's because the flowers are thirsty and they need the water. And that's a typical teleological explanation. Now, scientists, for the most part, do not accept teleological explanations because we know that it rains because of physics, and the physics have nothing to do with the existence of flowers or anybody else who might be thirsty. So that's what teleological thinking is, and it is very attractive to people. We start out as children thinking a lot in teleological terms, and then as adults, we tend to learn more and more that those explanations are not scientific, and we replace them with other explanations. But even as adults, we find it extremely attractive to think of things having a purpose. And that's where creationism comes in, because it turns out that most creationists, or in fact creationism quite explicitly, is about presuming that there is a purpose to things. You know, things were designed, animals, human beings, fish, giraffes, you know, they were designed in order to meet a certain purpose. For example, the giraffe has a long neck so that it can eat leaves from the top of trees. That's a teleological explanation. And that's scientifically incorrect, but it is very, very much part of.
So this gets to the crux of creationism, really, is this idea of an intelligent designer who created everything in the universe for a purpose. And that's also kind of the central organizing principle of conspiracy theories, that some group, or maybe in some cases an individual, you know, the Jews or the Illuminati, are pulling the strings behind the scenes, and what appear to be random events are actually being manipulated for a purpose.
Exactly. And that is, again, something that for some people is extremely attractive. Some people are just not prepared to accept that random events happen. Whenever something tragic or complex occurs, they seek an explanation other than coincidence or randomness. So, for example, when Princess Diana died in a drunk driving accident all those years ago, you know, that was a sort of tragedy, and it was a random, uncontrollable, erratic event. And a lot of people find that hard to accept. They would much rather think that there was an elaborate conspiracy involving MI5 or the CIA or MI6 or some other acronym of letters of a secret police. Yeah, that to people provides more of a chance that the world might be controllable than this sort of apparent randomness.
Now, as a writer, I would say that you had hooked this piece to a new study that came out. It was published recently by researchers at the University of Freiburg.
Yes.
Is it Freiburg? Freiburg?
It's Fribourg.
Fribourg.
It's in Switzerland. There's another Freiburg in Germany, but this is different. This is in Switzerland.
Okay. Can you tell us a little bit about that study?
Well, basically what they did was a number of studies, and they looked at everything we've touched on. They looked at creationism, conspiracy theorizing, and teleological thinking in their study, and they found that those are all associated with each other. And so in particular, there was an association between people who were predisposed to believe conspiracy theories and who were also creationists. Now, that is new information. I didn't know that before. However, the basic link between conspiracy theorizing and endorsement of pseudoscience accompanied by rejection of actual science, that link is well established. So we have known for decades that people who deny the link between the HIV virus and AIDS, for example, that they typically resort to conspiracy theories. You know, they think that AIDS was an invention of the CIA or the US Army or something that was meant to control gay people or whatever, you know. So that's always been the case. And there's a clear link between conspiratorial discourse and climate denial. I mean, if you look at the books of so-called climate skeptics, they're all full of, you know, things, words like hoax or the world government or, you know, these evil scientists trying to redistribute wealth or whatever it is, you know. So conspiratorial thinking is always very close at hand when you're talking about people who are rejecting well-established science.
Hey, this reminds me of a certain president of the United States who thinks climate change is a Chinese hoax. So at the risk of engaging in teleological thinking myself, is this about protecting oneself from information that conflicts with, you know, strongly held our worldview? Is it just motivated reasoning on steroids?
I think you're absolutely right. That is most likely what it is. And because it's quite clear that climate change is, it's a threat to our welfare for all of us on this planet. But doing something about the problem is a threat, in particular to people who are very much committed to the idea of free markets. And the reason for that is that they recognize that if you have to cut carbon emissions, that can only be done by either adding a tax or a price on carbon or regulation or something. You know, we have to do something to interfere with business as usual. There's no question about that. And for a lot of people, that is far more threatening than the risk from climate change itself, emotionally. And so if you're in that situation, what do you do? Well, one way to resolve that dilemma is to just dismiss climate change and say, oh, well, you know, the climate scientists made it up. It's just a hoax, or the Chinese made it up, or whatever. And we observe that also with chain smokers who are terrified by the medical information about lung cancer and smoking. And so one way in which they can cope, rather than by quitting, is to say that it's all a big conspiracy and that it's just the pharmaceutical industry trying to make money out of anti-cancer drugs or something.
And of course, the ultimate worldview that's threatened by the scientific evidence of evolution is that the world was created by the creator 6,000 years ago or whatever it was. If the many species that we see around us developed over millions of years through random genetic variations, that kind of puts that whole belief system at risk. If you're just tuning in, I'm speaking with Stefan Lewandowski from the University of Bristol. So you mentioned in the piece that that this correlation between a belief in creationism and a tendency to buy into conspiratorial thinking held true regardless of respondents' religious or political beliefs. And I wanted to just kind of interrogate that a little bit. At least here in the U.S., I don't know if this is universally true, religiosity is correlated to a degree with political conservatism. And of course,
yes,
creationism itself is a specific religious belief. Can you unpack that?
Absolutely. Yeah, no, that's a very good question. What that means is that the association between those two constructs transcended particular religious beliefs or political orientations. Now, that's not to say that the prevalence of creationism was the same across different believers or across different politics. Those are two very different things. So let me give you an example, a hypothetical example, just to illustrate this. It could be the case that among atheists, let's say only 1% or 2% of the population are creationists, whereas among fundamentalist Christians, maybe it's 50%. Whatever those numbers are, they can be absolutely dramatically different. Yet, for each group, it can be the case that there is an association between endorsement of conspiracy theories and belief in creationism. So irrespective of whether you're an atheist or a fundamentalist Christian, it could be the case that the more you believe in a conspiracy theory, the more you believe in creationism. And that is what this finding was about, that the association was the same. But that doesn't mean the absolute levels of belief would be the same across politics and religion. The two have nothing to do with each other.
I understand. Yeah, thank you for clearing that up for me. So you mentioned Princess Diana's death a minute or two ago. There was some research published a few years back which found that people can embrace or tend to embrace contradictory conspiracy theories. The researchers found that people who believe that Princess Diana was murdered were also more likely than the control group to believe she's alive. And they also ran a similar experiment with different conspiracy theories about Osama bin Laden's death. So people who thought he was already dead before the U.S. military raided that compound in Pakistan were also more likely to believe that he's still alive.
Exactly.
So you're familiar with this research?
Oh, yeah. That's by Karen Douglas at the University of Kent. Yes. No, I'm quite familiar with that work. And it, again, is an aspect of conspiratorial thinking. It's a very deep aspect of it. I wrote a paper, I think last year or the year before last, where I showed that this sort of inherent contradiction also occurs with climate denial. So, and you can actually hear this in public discourse all the time, that somebody who denies that the climate is changing will claim on the one hand, oh, we don't even know what the world's temperature is because the thermometers are too unreliable. But then a minute later, they'll say, oh, by the way, there hasn't been any warming in the last 15 years.
Right.
Now, you can't say, you can say one of those things, but not both together, because if you make a judgment about the temperature, you can't also make a judgment saying, oh, we can't measure the temperature.
Right, exactly.
Exactly. And so that inherent contradiction is an aspect of conspiracy theories as well as pseudoscience. Because it's pseudoscience because it is not scientifically coherent and supported by evidence. So that contradiction shows up wherever you go.
Fascinating stuff. Very fascinating. It's especially apropos to discuss this now, because right now here on this side of the pond, conspiracy theories have become kind of an integral part of our political discourse in a way that's extremely troubling for a lot of us who consider ourselves kind of rationalists, you know. Stefan Lewandowski, I believe we're about out of time. I want to thank you so much for sharing these findings with us. It's really interesting stuff.
Okay, well, thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Folks, read the piece at theconversation.com. It's titled, There's a Psychological Link Between Conspiracy Theories and Creationism. We're going to take a quick break and then be right back.
Why do my thoughts bloom so large on me? They seem to stay for day after day and won't disappear. I've tried every way, but she smiles sweetly. She smiles sweetly. She smiles sweetly and says, don't worry. Of her that keeps her peace most every day and won't disappear. My hair's turning gray, but she smiles sweetly. She smiles sweetly. She smiles sweetly and says, don't worry.
Back to the show. I'm still Joshua Holland. You know, I keep looking for glimmers of hope in these dark times, and I've been highlighting some of the groups that are doing work, real work, trying to save our Democratic Republic from white nationalist crackpots. I came across this group. It's called the Black Voters Matter Fund. They're doing very important work. I wanted to have their co-founder and executive director, Cliff Albright, on. I'm very happy to welcome him to the show. Cliff, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me. I know you're on a bus.
Yeah, definitely. We are on a bus, a big Black Voters Matter bus with all in black, with our logo all over it. And every time we stop someplace, folks are either breaking down or just in shock and awe. So yeah, we're on a bus right now as part of our 3-state, 7-day tour, bus tour.
So tell me about the work that Black Voters Matter Fund does.
Yeah, so we organize communities and we help provide support to communities and community-based groups to build local power, to build power in black communities. You know, elections are one way of doing that, although we by no means view ourselves as just an election organization or just a voting organization. So a lot of people know of us because of the work that we did in the December 2017 Alabama Senate race, where we helped mobilize black voters along with other organizations to turn out black folks, to help to beat Roy Moore, basically, and send him packing. But basically, that work, you know, we've been doing this work for over 20 years. And so over those 20 years of doing social justice work in general and voting work in particular, you know, we came up with certain approaches, or we kind of identified some approaches that have been done for decades, right? And part of that is that we believe in the power of local infrastructure, local electoral infrastructure, social infrastructure, and relationships. So we provide support to organizations that are local, on the ground, doing good work every day, 365 days out of the year, to help support their efforts to increase civic engagement, because we believe that messages about voting and civic engagement are best received when they're delivered by authentic messengers who have authentic relationships versus experts, so-called experts who might parachute in or, you know, hire outside folks to come in and try to tell people what they, you know, what they need to be doing. So we provide financial support to local groups. We provide strategy. We provide training. We provide tools like phone banking tools, like texting tools. We provide assistance with messaging, you know, to help provide messages that we know off of our experience or, you know, move Black voters to turn out, especially voters who don't usually turn out, right? Because it's one thing to turn out folks who always turn out. It's another thing to tap into that 50 or 60% of our communities that aren't turning out regularly for elections.
Do you see a change in that in terms of the era of Trump? Are people going to turn out who haven't traditionally turned out?
Yeah, I mean, we've seen that, you know, in a lot of places, again, not just in Alabama, where people were surprised. Keep in mind, the Alabama election was not a November election. It was a special election. It was December. It was in the middle or the early part of winter, right? So people said Black folks won't come out because it's cold. They said Black folks won't come out because it's a special election. Black folks came out and actually made up more of the voting population for that special election than during the Obama years. And so, yeah, people will turn out when you deliver the right message, right? We've seen that even after Alabama. We've seen that in places like we've been supporting groups in Tennessee, in Georgia, right now in Florida, whose primary is on Tuesday. In Tennessee just recently, we were supporting groups in Nashville who are organizing not just your traditional election campaigns, right? Now you've been talking about a particular candidate, but talking about an issue. Talking about the issue of police violence, trying to get a petition created in order to get a referendum on the ballot for November for community oversight of policing. And so they wound up getting twice as many signatures as what they needed. But in the process, during their election, their primary election, they also happened in Nashville or in Davidson County, which is where Nashville's the seat, they actually had the third highest increase in turnout of any county in the state of Tennessee. In Memphis, right, which has traditionally low voter turnout, there was increased Black turnout, which led to Democrats getting positions and sweeping basically their county level positions. And so we've already demonstrated. Again, it's not us; it's our local partners. Everything we do is about supporting local work, ongoing work. Have already demonstrated that with the right messengers and the right message, that people will turn out who don't usually turn out.
This is so important. These two points you're making, I think, are just crucially important. You can't helicopter in once every 2 years or every 4 years. You know, engagement on a regular basis, this kind of social engagement, is super important. And it is vitally important to have people who know a community working within a community. I say that in, you know, my local community, we've been doing a lot of organizing. We've been walking door to door to talk to people who are our neighbors, even without a specific candidate in mind. We're doing that. And that creates those kinds of relationships. Let me ask you this 3-state tour. What states are they and what are you doing specifically on this tour?
Yeah, so the states are Georgia, Mississippi, and Florida. So we did the first 2 days in Georgia on Wednesday and Thursday. And in both of those areas, and we went to 9 different cities and counties. And one of those was actually Randolph County, which you may be familiar with over the past few days, because there was a proposal to shut down 7 out of their 9 polling places.
Yes, very blatant.
Right, very blatant, right? And it was also discovered that the so-called consultants that's been going around advising these counties, because Randolph wasn't the only one, right? But the so-called consultant going around advising these counties to do these polling place closes is a consultant affiliated with Brian Kemp, who is the Secretary of State, the state's chief election official, while he's running for governor. Even Karen Handel, when she was Secretary of State, stepped down so that she could run for governor. Kemp has refused to do so, and we're seeing the results of that in terms of these strategies and these consultants going around trying to get people to close polling places and change hours and things like that. So that Randolph County was one of the 9 locations that we went to, and we were so pleased because today, Friday, due to pressure from the community and outside supporters and other partner groups like New Georgia Project, due to all this pressure and media coverage, they announced that they were throwing that plan away. And so, but we can't really celebrate. And that was just one of the places we went to. We went to Historic Americus, in Sumter County, Georgia. We went to historic Terrell County, Georgia. Like, we went to a lot of rural areas where they don't often get a lot of attention. We were on our way back from the Mississippi Delta. Again, part of that Black Belt region. It goes from Mississippi through Alabama, through Georgia, through Tennessee, through South Carolina. And so we were in the Mississippi Delta today, and we're actually on our way to Jackson, Mississippi, home of Mayor Tsokwe Antar Lumumba, hoping to be the nation's most radical city, right? And so we'll be meeting with groups there. And then after that, we'll be on our way to Florida. We'll be in Florida for the 2 days, the day before their election, their primary election is Monday the 27th, and then the day of the election on the 28th. And we'll be doing rolling block parties, going to polling places, and doing some canvassing. And everywhere this bus goes, I know you're on the radio, I wish you could have an image to go with it, because when people see it, then they know something different is rolling through their community.
Now, I understand that it's not that you're only working in rural communities, but there's kind of a focus on that, right?
Exactly. We do work in cities. Like, we're actually based in Atlanta, right?
Yeah.
Even back in the Alabama election, we did work in Birmingham and Montgomery and Mobile. But we have a special niche when it comes to the rural work, you know, because we understand, you know, Latasha Brown, co-founder, my colleague and dear friend, grew up in Selma, Alabama, grew up in the Black Belt, right? I lived in the Black Belt for 10 years before moving to Atlanta. So we know the isolation. We know what it feels like when you know you're doing good work, but it's, you know, nobody's paying attention, or you feel disconnected from folks in other counties or from national trends. So we know that. We know what that's like. And that's why we have that niche where we try to prioritize those rural areas. But we do work in the cities too. You know, we've done work in the Alabama cities. Like I said, in Tennessee, we were in Nashville, we were in Memphis, we're going to be in Chattanooga. So we do work in cities. In Florida, we're in rural counties that surround Tallahassee in North Florida, or as some people call it, South Georgia and South Alabama, right? Because the further north you go in Florida, the more southern you get.
Right.
And so in North Florida, you've got counties that are very much like the Black Belt, very Black, very rural, don't get a lot of attention. But we're also going to be in cities. So we'll be in Pensacola and Panama City, because we often, mid-sized cities or small cities often face the same issues that some of the rural communities face. Right. It's not Orlando necessarily or Miami. Right. But Pensacola has Black communities that are going through issues, and they get left out of a lot of these discussions. Like I said, Panama City, a city like Fort Pierce. So, you know, those small and mid-sized cities we'll also focus on as well. And we'll do some of the big cities, but that's not our, you know, we know those places are going to get some attention. But the interesting thing is, even when people pay attention to the cities, they still skip over Black voters. You know, or they skip over some segments of Black voters, right? Because if you're not a super voter, then nobody wants to talk to you.
Right.
Which then means you don't have the opportunity to become a super voter because you haven't been contacted.
Right, exactly, exactly.
So that's what we believe.
This seems like such important work. I mean, I just can't overstate it. Cliff, let me ask you, if my listeners wanted to support Black Voters Matter Fund, what should they do?
First off, you should follow us, especially right now. You should follow this tour and some of the things going on this tour and learning about the issues and seeing people's reactions. You can follow us on social media, Black Voters Matter, and that's Matter, MTR. So Black Voters with an S, MTR, and that's Facebook and Twitter. And you can go to our website. You go to Black Voters Matter Fund. That's Black Voters with an S, Matter Fund, as in money, F-U-N-D, .org. And you can support us there. You can also link from our 501c4 page, which is that page, to our 501c3 page. So if you're mainly interested in the capacity building pieces of what we do, you can support that way as well. You got two options on how you can support your work.
I also made a small donation via ActBlue in case listeners like to use ActBlue. I know
that's right.
Cliff Albright, I want to thank you so much for the work that you're doing, and thank you for taking the time to speak with me. I know you're busy on the tour.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having us on and helping to amplify these issues.
I also want to thank David K. Johnston and Stefan Lewandowski. You can follow me on Twitter at Joshua Hall. You can subscribe to the show at iTunes or Podbean or SoundCloud, wherever else you get your podcasts. I'd also like to thank the good folks at Crooks and Liars and Hullabaloo and the Smirking Chimp for letting me host the show at their respective joints. And of course, I'd like to thank all of you fine people for tuning in. Have a terrific week.